Hi, this is Gary Lactus.
And this right here is The Beast Must Die.
And you're listening to Silence, issue number 289, nearly the big 290.
Yes, for our 290th anniversary.
Still no telegram from the Queen.
Yeah.
Yes. Speaking of which, it's a shame not to use that helpful segue. It's your birthday tomorrow.
It is.
At time of recording.
It is. I'll be 100 years old tomorrow.
100 years old. As ever, I had all sorts of plans for doing something special for you. but yes, no. I can give you a conceptual song.
Oh yeah.
In lieu of the song that I didn't record.
Yeah.
All right. Imagine. Sure. you know when Marilyn Monroe sung the president "Happy Birthday"?
Oh yes.
That but me.
And instead of the words "Mr. President," you say, or maybe you just call me Mr. President. In the Real Housewives of Atlanta, which I had a mild fixation on a couple of years back and watched obsessively, one of the characters had a little baby and they called it Mr. President. I think that's an amazing name for a child.
Mr. President.
Mr. President.
That's good. That's good.
Really
my friend, my friend Ros Ryan made the joke. She can't wait for Melania to turn up on The Real Housewives of Orange Cunts. It's good, isn't it?
That's really good.
I liked that.
Because you think it's going to go somewhere a bit like, oh, yeah. But actually, no. It's really good.
Yeah, it's very Route 1, but also very good.
Let's
review the joke.
Welcome to Review the Joke, our new podcast where we take not that good a joke and dismantle it until it's really, really not that good.
So that was this week's joke. We're going to talk about that, take it apart for the next hour and a half. Come with us. Don't touch that dial. What's the name of the podcast? What's the name of the podcast?
It's called Review the Joke. It's really imaginative.
Review the joke. We're gonna review the joke. Yeah. With Gary Lactus and the Beast Must Die, they're gonna bump, review the joke.
And it's actually not. It's Gary Laughtus. And the joke must die.
Welcome to The Joke Must Die and Gary Laughtus. This is Review the Joke. First up, a word from our sponsors, which is some kind of mattress.
Mattress pants.
Made from Micromodal. Mattress pants. Never go to a specific place to sleep ever again with mattress pants.
MeUndies.com. So, I'm not going to ask how you've been. No one cares.
No.
What I want to know is,
who am I not sponsored by?
Tell me who you're not sponsored by.
I'm not sponsored by Dave's Comics of Brighton in Brighton. Yes, I believe you can click and collect. I must do that at the moment. I've got a few comics that I need to collect.
Yeah, there's a few things. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Some of which I'll be reviewing. I've just had to double dip and get digital copies. Yes, so there we go. That's Dave's Comics of Brighton, in Brighton.
I'm still sponsored by Gosh Comics of London, and they are good.
Gosh. Carry on.
I will. GoshLondon.com. Go and look at that, GoshLondon.com /TheGoshBlog. That's a good place to go because they update stuff a lot and they've got all sorts of nice things. And Yeah, it's good. It's a good website. They maintain it. They put a lot of effort into it, and it makes you feel a bit like you're still going to a comic shop. So, yeah, support, support, support.
Indeed, yes, do that. Speaking of Gosh Comics of London, I need to email Tom there about them. I've been meaning to do it for months about them stocking Journey to the Surface of the Earth, issue 2.
Mm.
But do you know what? It doesn't seem like the urgency at the moment.
I don't know what the small press situation is, but I'm not sure. Like, yeah, it's yeah, I don't know. Go and peruse the small press. Yeah, anyway. Hey, listen. With the Beast Must Die. I bought and I read your comic. I mean, I'd already read it, but I believe the children of the future. I also believe that a physical embodiment of a thing I'd read digitally in spurts is much better. So I got to consume it as a whole.
I think there were two or three pages that you hadn't read before.
Possibly so. Yeah. But yeah,
The guy with a stick up his nose? I don't think you'd read that.
Oh yeah, no, possibly yeah. not. But to sort of sit down, especially with an anthology like that, where it's very much a throwback, not a throwback, but calling back to those sort of one man anthologies of the 80s and 90s. So you kind of want the actual physical copy, or at least I do. You know what I'm like, such a Luddite. But it was great. I really loved it, and I really do. It was, you know, easily your most consistently excellent thing for since we were kids, when I was just always very impressed by the fact that you'd done anything. It's really good, and I'm a big fan of the Scroodles myself, but the range of strips and the way your art has kind of notched up a bit because of the tablet that you're using.
It's because of the iPad. Yeah,
that's lovely though. It's really like you've really leaned
easy
into
access
it.
To tracing, basically.
No. It's not that. You've kind of made it work really well. The whole your art's kind of got a lovely, nice sort of dense quality to the line and a sort of confidence to it. It's just really good. It's all the stuff that was there before, but you've taken this new tool and used it well, which is kind of what new tools are for. They should be, unless you're a seasoned 1970s/80s British comics creator and you're let loose on Photoshop, in which case you should have that taken, those rights rescinded.
Yes.
But no, it was great.
It's still line work. It's not. It's not digital painting.
No, you know. Christ, no. And it was.
I couldn't do that anyway.
No,
man, if I tried, that would look really bad.
No, it was really good though. Yeah. It's lovely. It's even got like a really kind of considered, excellent joke contents page and stuff. I really like that. It's a complete package, just like the man who made it. Classic.
Oh,
Apocalypse
thank you.
Clarkson.
Yeah, there's lots of good Paul quotes there from the podcast.
Take what you like from
do.
There, mate. yeah, from your own podcast, reviewed by your old friend. But it's good, and I do urge anybody who has resisted buying because they don't like you to still buy it because it's very good.
Yes, it's better than my podcasting skills.
It's better than you as a person.
Yeah, better than me as a person, better than my podcasting skills, better than any of the audible flatus that I may produce during a recording. Sorry about that again.
No, that was good. I didn't notice, but a listener did.
Yeah, it was quite audible. But anyway, do excuse me. Yes, so this is Silence, and you're right, it's your birthday tomorrow.
Yeah.
Are you excited about your, are you going to be 44?
Oh, gosh, yes, I am. Yes. Am I excited? No. It'll be all right. It'll be a bit different. I mean, it'll be a bit different. It won't be just another day. So that
you'll be at home working and going, oh, it's my birthday.
And also because my daughter is, we've got to keep my daughter at home at the moment because the mini beast, because she hurt herself, so she's off nursery. And so she'll be at home too. So it will be just a busy day, really. Although she's been loads of fun. I've enjoyed having her at home recently because whilst it's much easier having her go to nursery, it's also like fun having her crazy little brain just fizzing around the house as well. That's just loads of fun. And occasional stops from working to go and play Hungry Hippos is fine. That's an okay thing to do with your day. So
yeah. And she can take a break from Hungry Hippos and really brighten up a spreadsheet. Yeah, no doubt.
I was actually on a meeting with with my executive, who are like the basics, a bit like going and having a meeting with the Justice League. It's they're the big guns. It's like me being Booster Gold and actually going to meet the real Justice League. It's like that, you know.
Oh, there are a bunch of people called the Executive.
The Executive, yeah, they are.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and when I go into their office, they're all in massive... it's like the parallax view, basically. I go in, they're just like a huge shadowy cabal sat behind very high desks. And you can't see their faces. They're all in shadow. And you just stand in a spotlight and deliver your presentation or whatever it is you've got to talk about. But no, I was talking to him earlier, Esmo was just like, I'm sorry, the mini beast was just going mental. And I said, oh, sorry, that's my daughter. And they were like, that's fine. Then later on, my head of the place I work basically was like, unless your daughter has anything to say. And I was like, I really want to be like, yeah. And he wasn't being mean. He was being funny. And I really wanted to be like, let me just bring her on the line. Let's be honest. It's going to make this call a lot better if she's suddenly involved. but yeah, anyway, that's...
Yeah. Be like that big train sketch where it's like, look, we haven't been paid for a month yet, but look, here's some puppies.
Do you know what? I think about Big Train a lot and how...
Yes, yeah.
It was really, really fucking good, and it doesn't seem to come up very often. It launched a bunch of careers, and it kind of put a bunch of young people who've now become extremely well known, you know, onto it. Was on like BBC One or BBC Two in the kind of mainstream slot. And it, what was it, Graham Linehan and Arthur Matthews, I think, wasn't it? Was it?
Yeah. And well, it was lots of people.
Yeah.
The sketches I think of are those with the boss, wanking in the office.
Yeah.
And what's his name? The Beatles producer.
Oh, George Martin being kidnapped.
George Martin getting kidnapped and still going, oh, of course, George said to me.
just
endlessly.
Yeah.
And being, like, put in the back of a van and, like, wheeled out of various, like, boxes and stuff like that and being transported and all the time just mumbling on about the Beatles. So good.
There was also a really good one, a bit horrid, but there's just like Kevin Eldon just being like, it's a dinner party, and then Kevin Eldon's just like being a typically like boorish, unpleasant man. And he's just basically telling a really embarrassing story about his wife and just like, you know, frothing at the mouth and really like leaning into this appalling kind of embarrassing anecdote. And eventually she just stabs him in the chest and then he's just like bleeding and gurgling and dying at the table, and the camera's just like panning between, and because it's just like a middle class dinner party, they're all just going, and you know, the wife's like, I'm sorry about that, you know, he just really does just and they're like, no, it's fine. And like, it's just Simon Pegg's face, he's just kind of pulling this kind of uh-oh kind of look but not saying anything, and it's just like really wonderful, this camera panning back and forth.
A lot of it is about the performances, isn't it, like with the a lot of them were worked up from just ideas, like Adam and Joe were part of the writing team, I think. And the wanking in the office was Adam Buxton's idea.
That makes sense.
And but I think he said that basically the what he wrote was, what if wanking in the office was the same as smoking? And then, you know, they all went away, that, like, you know, I think Simon Pegg had a lot of input into it. They're just sort of bat ideas around, and a lot of it was about the performance as well. And you can see that a lot of it, you couldn't really write. It wouldn't work on the page, but, you know, you can sort of workshop it as performers. And, yeah, made some really good stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Shame about Graham Linehan now.
Yeah, I mean, it is. But luckily, like I say, he was sort of one of a number of people, et cetera, et cetera. And also, whatever, that work is still really good. But it's funny. It's just one of those things. I really think it's... I haven't seen it for a while, but I just remember for a sketch show, it was an astonishing hit rate of success and just really quite... a bit of a game changer in a way, but still being like a sketch show. And I just sort of, it doesn't seem to come up. Maybe it just does. It does come up if you're a sort of, if I spent as much time reading about old comedy stuff as I do, you know, other things, then maybe it would. But I just, you know, things get name checked and it's not one of them, man.
Yeah.
There's a couple of them like that, and look
it,
around.
It is held in quite high regard, and a lot of people do mention it within, because I listen to loads of comedy podcasts, and it does come up.
Definitely for that, I'm sure. Yeah. So, but that and what was it, Serafina, which is. Look Around You. I really loved Look Around You.
Him and Robert Popper.
That's right, yeah, Robert
that
Popper.
Was so good.
Yeah, the first series
that
is
last year.
The first series is better. The second series is not as good. I don't know why. It just I think the running time is a bit longer or something. But the first series is really like astonishingly good.
it broke the second series. It's still good. I still really enjoy it. But it did break the sort of period verisimilitude a bit. Remember, it had when it had guests come on, they would step out of this clearly, like, you know, kind of crap CGI vault, and it really broke like all the effort that was being put in everywhere else to make it genuinely seem like an artifact from 1981. You know, there was a lot of visually, there were a lot of,
yeah, the texture and work. The stock and everything really in the first series is spot on. It really reminds me. I mean, it's such a it speaks to our generation completely, but it really reminds me of the stuff that you would in class in science, where you'd suddenly be allowed to like watch like stop, look, learn or whatever it was, and it would be some, you know, how a ball bearing factory works or something like that, and it had this real ambience to it that has been is well kind of milked now because of the whole, you know, fetishization of like late 70s early 80s British TV really. But I do remember like when I first came across Look Around You being like, oh shit, someone's completely nailed that feeling of like those weird, surreal, slightly dreary science shows from when you're a kid. Very good. The one on ghosts is particularly great.
Wonderful work. But that whole interest of stuff in that time has really it's helped my dad out, because he did a lot of music for education programs around that time. Basic maths and leapfrog and all of these sorts of things.
It's
that sort of interest that sort of you know, has people. I think Johnny Trunk has released some of his soundtrack stuff recently for the short films of Steve Dwoskin, and I listened to it for the first time the other day because it was on Spotify. And I was playing with little Barry Lactor saying, oh, this is Pop Pop's music.
Oh,
my dad playing a kind of sped up mutant ragtime piano. And there's this one tune called Alone. Bearing in mind it's supposed to go with visuals, but it's just like one low note on the piano repeated.
Right.
And we were playing with the train set whilst this was on, and he turned to me and said, I don't like this one.
Yeah.
Don't like this one. It's like, yeah. Yeah, no. Anyway,
you?
Yes, go on Spotify and check out Ron Giesin, should you wish to know some of the sounds that my father has made historically.
You totally should as well. I mean, like, you know, with all the contextualization you feel the need to make when discussing his work. I mean, he is like, he's pretty like a pretty phenomenal avant-garde slash I don't know, really, experimental musician of some repute and a genuine idiosyncratic figure in the pop cultural landscape. So I think the fact that he's your dad and you have to kind of caveat stuff a bit shouldn't dissuade people from genuinely going, yeah, he's fucking excellent, Ron, basically. So, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose I could, if you want to know about my dad's writing as well, he's got a book out recently called The Stapled Brain, which he's selling from his website. It's collected writings and photos, I think, from the mid-60s to fairly recently, I guess. I really didn't like the cover.
No.
And I let him know about it. And he sent me a copy, and he did a special, a very special brown paper dust jacket with special edition printed on the side.
That's excellent.
Yeah. And yeah, that rescued it. And you can always make your own dust jacket, dear listener. Should you end up buying The Stapled Brain from rongeeson.com. And the aforementioned Journey to the Surface of the Earth issue 2 is available from my website, FraserGeeson.com.
Frasered Geeson.
Oh, this Geeson is well phrased. And I think
that's quite enough flannel
promotion of me and my family.
Yeah, sure.
And also, my mum is a doctor of knitted fabrics. And if you find yourself at a craft fair, either in Chiddinglie or Seaford, in the future, you may well see some of her electroplated knitting or other things. So why not try Frances Geeson? I think she might have a website as well. Don't know when last time that was updated. Anyway, what about your mum and dad?
Oh, well,
what are they shilling right now?
My mum's got an album of experimental shell music. It's all music played on shells that she's found on.
By women called Shell.
It's an orchestra of women called Shell, all playing shells that were found down on Pevensey Beach. It's 28 hours of improv shell music, and my mum is the band leader. So she's got that.
Does she hold the big conch?
Yeah, the album starts with a mighty bellowing conch noise, and that's my mum.
she summons all the me shells.
Yeah, she summons the shells, and they start playing the shells, and the album is called The Kraken Awakes, brackets, Pevensey Beach Suite.
Good. And your dad?
My dad, he's just got a hat that has got the number of a train that he likes on it, for real, that he wears now, which I like. He's really into steam trains.
The number of a train?
Yeah, yeah.
On
so,
a hat?
On a hat, yeah. Like, I was on a FaceTime.
Is it like, I'm imagining it sticking out like a press pass.
Yeah. No, it's like, I got on the FaceTime with them earlier to have a little conversation with the mini beast, and I was wearing a sort of beanie hat because my hair was fucking me off, and I was just like, just wore my hat because I live at home now, so who fucking cares? And and so my dad a sort of spirit of freedom, my dad put his beanie hat on. And it's this like black hat with like a train number on it, you know, like on the side of a steam train. You get the number. It's got that on it. It's just like, I was like, that's what you're doing now with your retirement. Good, into it. So that's my family. Hey, listen.
Hey, comics.
No, before we go to comics, I'm going to do a new segment called Hey, Listen. I've been listening to something because I have been listening to something, and I just thought I'd mention it because it may be of tangential interest to the silence listeners. I have been partially enjoying the audio podcast, which I think is called The Lovecraft Investigations. That's on the BBC
Radio 4
player. Yeah, it's on Radio 4. Now, I'm just going to
I've heard bits of it, and I thought, this is a bit like Alan Moore.
Well, yes, it's interesting. So it is called the Lovecraft Investigation. So they started off doing the case of Charles Dexter Ward. They then did the Whisperer in Darkness, and now they've done the Shadow over Innsmouth, which are all Lovecraft stories. What this is, though, is a mock sort of podcast, investigation podcast. So ever since Serial, basically, there have been a whole slew of these spooky mock podcasts. Not that Serial was mock, it was real, but the framework that Serial established with Sarah Koenig and her investigation and all the kind of incidental music and pithy observations.
High production
values. High production values and sort of that slightly informal, like, so I'm talking to blah, 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 who is the so-and-so
like
something. Yeah, just like us. So it uses that framework, and it's contemporary. It's set. Obviously, it's not a podcast set in the 40s or 20s. So it's a contemporary spin on Lovecraft. And what I would say is what I do like about it is that they have sort of thought through how to adapt Lovecraft in an interesting way. And there are a number of these things, like the Black Tapes and Tanis and Video Palace and all sorts of ones, because I'm really obsessed by the idea of spooky podcasts, because I think the audio medium has a lot of potential for doing stuff to be genuinely scary. And so I kind of thought, oh, I wonder if anyone's done any kind of fictional scary podcast. And lo and behold, a few people have. And I explored things like the Black Tapes and Tanis, which are quite sort of well-known versions. And there's a whole bunch of them. They all follow the same thing, like a mock investigative podcast. Things start to go wrong and blah, blah, blah. And they are of variable quality. Some are much worse than others, but they all suffer for me from this real, like, annoying need to continue the conceit of the investigative podcast, even when it gets to a point where you're like, well, of course you just, why are you still, what the fuck? Anyway, but so this uses that, and it is familiar, but it's much better acted than most of them. It's transatlantic, so you've got an American. One of the hosts is American, and one's English, so that helps. It's not too American. There's a bit of Englishness to it, and that gives it a nice sort of quasi Radio 4 feel. And I think that the unfurling of a mystery, an investigative mystery, into kind of Lovecraftian conspiracies is kind of decent and quite compelling. And I have like raced through it in the last couple of weeks, just like I found it quite compelling and I found it quite enjoyable. But I do think that Lovecraft is a fucking weird one to not make more scary, because the point about Lovecraft is one of the things that people struggle with is that he's kind of like this unknowable, unnameable, indescribable cosmic horror. People are often like, what about a guy with a squid for a head? Maybe. What about, you know, and people come a bit unstuck when it comes to trying to nail that sort of ineffable, unknown quality. And audio feels like, to me, a really good potential way to do Lovecraft. And the kind of warping of reality that you could do with audio stuff is really good, and with kind of recordings. But it's just one of those things where they get too caught up in this kind of like almost like globe-trotting conspiracy, and they forget that like Lovecraft should be scary. So there's just all this like. It starts off reasonably small with an investigation in a small American town, and then it just gets bigger and bigger. And eventually, by like the third series, they're just flying all over the world, and there's like, you know, mysterious cabals of people with sort of vested interests and secret agent type characters, mysterious. But I realised halfway through that what it really was, of course, was massively influenced by Alan Moore and Grant Morrison. And that whole school, and particularly, I think, the Invisibles, actually. It was really, really Invisiblesy. Not in the good way of the Invisibles, but in the, sort of, who's this mysterious character? Who do they work for? What is the Harlequin? What is the Wild Hunt? All this stuff, you know, they're bringing up stuff. The way that they kind of, just the sort of globe-trotting conspiracy, really, it felt, I was like, I would be so surprised if the people behind this weren't big, big, big Invisibles fans. And that would track, really, if they're probably our age or younger. Then no doubt they might have come of age in the 90s with the whole, you know, that whole conspiracy and the secrets of the universe stuff knocking around. So that I have some sympathy and some, you know, there's some part of me that's like, I quite like this. But I was just like, man, why the fuck isn't this more weird and scary? It's so weird. Like, I don't understand, like, why you haven't kind of leaned into it. Because when you're actually... I've gone for a couple of walks.
My problems with it have been the form, really, is like you know, like you say, the sort of the need for these, like, bits of exposition, which sort of break the... just sort of break the whole concept of you know what you're supposed to be listening to. It's a shame, but no, the bits I've caught I have enjoyed in that way, but I have at the same time been a bit, you know, comics were there first, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's, yeah, that whole sort of formal conceit of the podcast, it kind of, it, once it starts getting to a certain point, they have to start doing all this, like, fuckery where they're like, the narrator's like, so I know what happens here, but we've obviously put, because it's like, hold on, what, you've edited this all together, but hold on, if this had happened and this had happened, why would you? So they have to kind of, yeah, these kind of weird expository, like, footwork they have to do to get to a place where it still makes sense and all this stuff. It's just pointless.
It's the same sort of tangle that found footage films often get themselves stuck.
Really? Yeah. Exactly that. Yeah, really. Yeah. And even, you know, even the very best of those, the Blair Witch, which is still, you know, because of the way it's done, because of that curious moment of lightning in a bottle and just just something that happened, even that film has one moment where, like, Heather, the main character, is just like, I guess I've just got to keep filming because it's all I have or something, and it's like, yeah, no one would ever say that or do that, but fine, let's just carry on, you know. Even the best of it, yeah, so there's that kind of thing. And also, like, enforced informal banter. These things are so scripted, they're so rigidly scripted, that even with the best actors, and to its credit, it does have some very good actors. There's a couple of people in it who I'm like, you're actually kind of selling me on this character and doing a good job. But when they do that whole back and forth that humans do, they never, like, talk over each other. They never, like, interrupt. They never, like...
It's more the back and forth that humans don't.
Yeah. And it's just really...
Everybody's taking their turn to speak.
Yeah. And so, and what I hate is when they do that and then they have that bit where, like, hold on, actually. But it's, like, not... It's not actually... It's scripted and it's... it just really, like, fucking makes my skin crawl. So... But it is... I would say it is worth... a listen for people. I mean, I know a couple of people who've enjoyed it a lot. I think if you're more forgiving of the kind of cults and conspiracies take, rather than, because what I want is something that pushes into a more, like, I would just, if I was going to do it, I would just fuck it off, fuck the mock investigative report thing, just do a drama, but just go, oh well, hold on a minute, You know, you could update it. You can kind of come up with new ways to look at it. It doesn't have to be like a period piece or anything. But sound is so potent, it's like, you know, like on a recent Savage Beast, we talked about the Stone Tape, and the Stone Tape is a Nigel Neal scripted British sort of sci-fi horror film from the 70s, TV horror film. The audio in that is like a massive part of why it's so fucking scary. It's because it's the Radiophonic Workshop, obviously, going to town. And it's, you know, at certain points, that whole thing is like some fucking very difficult to listen to experimental jazz record. And you just think, God, just to have something where, you know, actually you're in your headphones and you're a bit lost, and it's like, you can make people do all sorts of things and get really creeped out. Maybe people don't actually want to do that, though. They sort of want that cozy, oh, it's a bit spooky, a bit creepy, but essentially it's not that weird or terrifying. Maybe that's, you know, you don't want to alienate people too much with audio stuff, but it's frustrating for what it could be, I think.
Yeah. I think there's definitely a space for audio drama that's kind of a bit more like Blue Jam, you know, or
yes, Blue Jam's a great point though, because that really sort of suggested a way of things that was not followed up on at all, ambient. Atmosphere, comedy, horror thing.
Having said that, I actually listened to your, this reminded me of something I actually listened to today. I'm quite late to this party. The Beef and Dairy Network.
I like it already.
you haven't heard of the Beef and Dairy Network? Okay, it is a comedy podcast. By a guy called Benjamin Partridge, and who teams up with lots of other people. Mike Wozniak is normally involved, and all of the sort of banter and dialogue in that is very natural. It's a podcast about. All right, I'll just read the official thing. What is it? The number one podcast for those involved or just interested: the production of beef animals and dairy herds. And there was a whole in today's one. There was two threads. There was the beef line, which had recently changed its number to one, where you can phone in, you answer a question, and you could win a lifetime supply of beef. And also the recent report on the 2020 farmyard incidents. An accidents report, and it focused in on the issue of the misuse of milking machines, and there was a bit in it where this recurring thing about the beef line just turned into this sort of ambient horror.
Right.
But it is presented really well. It's high production. It's presented like a sort of You and Yours type radio 4 type thing. I would highly recommend that. You could jump in at any point.
Yeah, because
the most recent one, episode 67, Milking Machine Misadventures, was good. And yeah, I would just suggest anyone interested in good use of podcast, the podcast medium, and naturalistic performances, check that out.
Yeah, because that's a thing as well, isn't it? Is the naturalism can be achieved in ways that is perhaps by getting non-actors sometimes. Or maybe just, I don't know, just taking a more sort of improvise that word.
Yeah, I honestly don't know how they've done it. I mean, they could like have... It sounds like they've got the sort of main points that they need to hit. Another thing, the horror. They had this whole thing about they'd sacked their PR person and they kept ringing up because Ted Danson wanted 23 million tons of grain. And things were getting worse every time she rang in. And she was hiding in a cardboard box. And Danson was in her house and she could hear his claws and his low bell. The low bell of Danson.
That's
and she was absolutely terrified. Yeah, I'd really recommend it. Today's was a very good one. Yeah, it's the sort of thing if you can... I sort of binged them to begin with and it sort of got a bit like, oh, yeah. I think it's the sort of thing that needs to be kept as a treat.
But, yeah.
You know, there's 67 of the fuckers.
Right.
You know, it'll keep you going. The Beef and Dairy Network.
That sounds absolutely great. Yeah, there was.
We will get to comics, dear listener.
We will, but fuck it.
It's your birthday. Exactly. This is your birthday party.
Exactly. another thing that Lord Nuneaton Savage, Matt Colgate, my co-host of Savage Beast, pointed towards me was a thing on YouTube called Petscop, PETSCOP, which is a really fucking astonishingly good sort of ambient horror experience, which involves a guy playing through a really weird game that he remembers vaguely from his past, that on like the PlayStation or something. And I don't really want to say anything about it because I don't want to give anything away. It's much better just to go in and just start experiencing it. But it is so clever and so weird and so convincing. And, you know, you're just watching someone playing a game. And if you've ever sat and watched someone play one of these games where they're kind of exploring a world, trying to work out the logic of a world, if you're not into it, if you're not a gamer, it can be really odd to watch someone play it. It's like, how on earth have you got the patience for this? But it can also be quite seductive and sort of alluring. I'm not a gamer. It's not something I do. But I've sat and watched like a mutual friend of ours, who's a bit of a sort of insomniac and got a bit more of that sort of dedication to exploring this, playing something like, I don't know, a Zelda game, and just watching this kind of ambient sort of hum of a game being played slowly. So it's got that, and then occasionally, because it's a playthrough, you've got like a voiceover of this guy going, "Oh, that's odd. I'm not sure what that means. I seem to remember." And he's just really kind of like half-arsedly sort of talking, but it's really convincing. It's really well done. It's not got that phony quality, and it's really anonymous and weird. And they're varying lengths.
So this is Petscop. P-E-T-S.
COP, all one word, and there's just a number of videos numbered from like 1 to like 24 or something, and some of them are like 3 minutes and some of them are like 16 minutes, and there's big chunks of it where no one is talking and nothing's really happening, and then occasionally just something, but the weirdness of the game, I mean, it's the closest to kind of, Lynch is such a lazy comparison, but it's got that sort of genuine unease that Lynch at his most abstract has. And yeah, I mean, it's similar, like you were saying. I started binging through it because I was so obsessed by it, and then I was like, it's actually quite tedious in places, so you do need to sort of it's a very specific thing. I recommend turning the lights off and just watching it in the dark. It works a treat. But yeah, very good and very, very ambient and very odd. Yeah, so it's really cool. Right, anyway, so that's the preamble before we talk about comics.
Yes, that's just over 40 minutes, I think.
Quality.
And actually, the battery on my recorder looks like it's running down.
Oh,
looks
geez.
Like it lied to me about the amount of juice in my machine. But it's all right, I've got my backup going. So, shall we?
Let's do it.
Come on with us to Review Universe with Gary and the Beast and you, of course.
Gave it some this week.
Oh, yes.
Been doing a lot of singing recently.
Have you? Just in your child's face.
yeah. Well, it's the easiest way of getting him to do... He would never have his hair brushed at the end of the day until... The Lady Lactus's mum gave us for Christmas this hairbrush, which has got like rainbows and sort of glitter in the back of it in a sort of clear window. And so I started singing this song when I brushed his hair, and now he's fine with it. He's fine with having his hair brushed because I found the right song. You just got to find the right song.
Mate, we've all got to find the right song. That's just a message for life, isn't it? Go on.
Magic sparkle, rainbow magic. Magic sparkle, rainbow magic. Magic sparkle, rainbow magic is running through your hair. And I sing it really seriously like that.
That's, yeah, I mean, that's beautiful. Yeah. I would definitely brush my hair if you sung that at me. I would feel obliged to. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good song.
It's a really good song. It's a fucking good mate. Song, mate. Well done, mate.
Yeah.
Well done, mate.
Yeah. All right.
What have you read then, prick?
What have I read? All right then, you fucking cunt. Birthday cunt. I read. What did I read? I read. It's a sort of silence related thing, in a way. I read Batman Annual number 5. Yes, Batman, the popular character who's been going now for 5 years. Who knew it was only 5 years ago Batman came out? The 5th annual Batman comic. Written by James Tynion IV and with art by James Stokoe. It's a lovely, you get a lovely big bunch of James Stokoe.
Wadda Stokes.
Yes, our sort of, what is he?
Slave.
I mean, he's our slave.
He's our art slave.
He's our art slave. Our volunteer art slave. What an idiot. I haven't read Batman for a good amount of time. Apparently there's been something called Joker Wars going on. Which I haven't read any of. I stopped somewhere. I think Bobsey ruined Tom King for me. And I sort of stopped reading it. And then of course I stopped being sponsored, so it wasn't like I was. And also, like, Batman is like, to keep on top of Batman, there's a lot of comics to read. There's a lot of Batman comics. But I thought, I'm definitely picking up this one because James Stokoe's drawn it. And, so there's this thing called Joker Wars, and there's this character has turned up called, Clown Killer. Have you come across Clown Killer?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. So he is new. He's not some legacy thing. He's an anti-Joker vigilante in Gotham. He's basically he's a kid with a sort of with a helmet with this sort of Mohegan design on it, and he's got a baseball bat with a batarang through it, and he just sort of bashes in Joker gang people with it, and it's his origin, and yeah, it's, you know, it's a fine story. It's the usual thing. It's one of those stories that's like, what can you do in Batman with something like, I don't know, well, pretty much most popular superhero ongoing things. You kind of have to have your fun in the gaps, you know, because there's so much canon that you can't touch and you can't fundamentally change. There's two approaches. You can like sort of change the fundamentals, but kind of in a way that doesn't matter, like every single event ever, you know.
Yeah.
Or you can sort of have fun in the gaps. And so it's like, okay, there's this character. Let's look at his origin. Fine. Spoilers. This kid's parents, they run a restaurant. Harley Quinn and Joker come in. They've heard that they do really nice fur, however you're supposed to pronounce it. Apologies if I'm pronouncing it wrong. they have it, and like this kid's parents are just like, no, let's just serve him, let him go. And of course, you know, he's the Joker, he's crazy, he just kills them.
And then
pays and sort of leaves this kid, and he meets Batman. Batman gives him a batarang and he says, like, you know, I'll sort this out. But then this kid is growing up without his parents, and the Joker is doing attack upon attack on, and, you know, he's never acting. It doesn't appear like Batman ever does anything about this guy. So he bashes his this batarang through his baseball bat, puts on a sort of improvised helmet, and goes out this sort of during these Joker wars where there's lots of Joker gangs and these Joker masks running amok. And he starts bashing people's heads in.
That sounds great. I'm loving this already.
Yeah, and it's all drawn by James Stocco. So, I mean, really, that's all you need.
Yeah.
There's a lot. There's actually a lot of him talking to this doctor lady who runs like a sort of, she's a very charitable Gotham doctor who runs this sort of free clinic who helps people out, because obviously Gotham is a weird and fucked place. And so she's sort of talking to him. There's a lot of that going on, but it's all drawn by James Stocco. And it's just amazing. There's like these sort of
holy fuck! I'm just looking at some of these pages.
You just look at there's an I think it's like on the second or third page. There's like this alleyway where, like, any sane person would just use a lot of black, but he's cross-hatched this entire thing. It's just unbelievable. And there's this Batman that's all made out of bats, this sort of Batman silhouette. There's like, you know, you never get an actual silhouette. Every silhouette is made up of, like, you know, thousands of tiny lines. And, like, not just like a sort of blur of lines, not that sort of Liefeld, I'll put a load of lines on, you know, people think it's a good drawing. It's like, yeah, it really is like, it's an opportunity to have a good old bunch of sequential Stocco.
Yeah, he's
working hard on it as well.
It's a bit different, isn't it? It's not as knobbly as some of his stuff. It's a little bit smoother in some ways, I think, looking at some of the figure work. There's a bit more of a sort of lazy, you know, comparison, but a bit more of a kind of Otomo, Katsuhiro Otomo vibe to some of the panels and stuff. It's fucking
I'm
lush.
Sure he wouldn't be offended.
No, there's just way more accurate manga artists, but I always just feel like Otomo is such a sort of benchmark that, you know, but anyway, it's lovely.
But there's still sort of Stocco-isms in the design. There's this, I keep coming back to this alleyway panel. There's a street lamp, and just like the sort of design of the street lamp is like, I don't know if that's based on a street lamp that exists, but it's definitely a Stocco-y street lamp. I was just like, that's a really good street lamp. The art really does elevate this story into something that's, you know, worth the price of a comic.
Who did you say wrote it?
James Tynion 4.
Oh, it's James Tynion 4. The fourth upgrade of the James Tynion cyborg.
Yes. Mm. You know, there's nothing like, it's well told. The writing's good, you know, it's not bad. But
it's not the point.
Yeah, it's really not the point. The point is the experience of reading this comic, really. Which both people are like. If it wasn't drawn by Stocco, I wouldn't be talking about it.
Yeah, I think it is a character outside. I don't think he's a new character.
I think he's reasonably new. I think he's new. I think he's part of the post, what's his name? Fucking hell. Snyder and Capullo Batverse. Right. I believe he's something to do with this, because I'm just, and the only reason I'm saying that is because I'm just having a look and I can see other people have drawn this Clown Hunter character. So I'm assuming that he is, yeah, he exists as part of something. So, but who gives a fuck, really? That's not the point.
Yeah, no, I'd recommend it. Yeah, and yeah, like I say, I had to buy this digitally to read it because I still haven't got the opportunity to go to the comic shop and phone up beforehand, arrange a time, safely. I don't know how they they're handing over comics.
They fired them from a cannon out into I went to an Argos the other day and like just buying something from Argos involved like going out to the door and there was like a table in front of the door and someone like went and got a box from all these piles of boxes on the floor and I was like, my god, this really does feel like black market buying in the fucking war. It's so weird. It's Argos. Anyway, there's my daughter's Buckaroo set, thank you. Yes. weird.
Oh, you got Buckaroo now.
Buckaroo and Hungry Hippos, mate, fucking great. Both right, okay. Recommended. I mean, we already knew they were great, but now you get to play them with your kids. It's awesome. That sounds fucking great. I like the sound of that. I read something that is not great, but I sort of enjoyed it anyway. I was talking about the terrible Egyptian dread story that Morrison and Miller wrote, the Book of the Dead, last ep. And I made reference to the later work by them that appeared after I'd stopped reading the big 2K and Judge Dredd Crusade. And my helper fairy, who I occasionally turn to at times when I can't locate things, helped me out by providing me with Judge Dredd Crusade to read. So this was... I think it ran in post 900 progs. So it prog 934 or something. I don't know. I could find out if I was not being lazy. But it was sort of, I feel like it was sitting in a drawer rather than it was written, because I think there was a sort of moment where Morrison and Miller were writing stuff for the 2000 AD. And I think this was probably something that was sitting there and they were like, this is kind of shit, so but fuck it, let's run it. And it ran after the summer offensive and all that stuff,
right? And then Wagner did a big story after that, didn't he?
I think there was a whole chunk of, there was like Wilderlands and stuff, I think,
well, there's Wilderlands and there was that crossover with Rogue Trooper after that, through Graham and Jeff.
It's funny because it's sort of reminding me of my past, because I was like, oh yeah, I remember that. About this is about where they are up to now is about where I stopped reading. So after prog 900, in fact it might even have been like, I don't know, but I remember getting a certain point and just being like, I fucking hate this now. And it's really weird because I look back and it's just like, it's this really short period of time when I read 2000 AD ardently on a weekly basis. And a lot of it I hated. But it's just that the good stuff is so good. So this is written by Grant Morrison and Mark Miller and drawn by Mick Austin. Now, Mick Austin, I would say, is one of the sort of great lost British artists. He's not lost. He worked fairly constantly from, I think, the 70s, through to, I don't know, into the 2000s. I'm not sure how much he's working now. The guy must be quite old. He did covers for Warrior and things like that. I think he probably did stuff. I think he probably did covers for, like, Dead Skin, for, like, Hammer House of Horror and all that stuff. He's a really good, like, he does wonderful painted art, and his like pen and ink work is really nice, and he's got a sort of loose cartoony style that's really sort of confident. There's a kind of old school quality to it,
that shows some sort of art school training, I think, rather than just being raised on comics. It feels a bit more,
yes,
a bit closer, yeah, to, yeah, sort of like someone who's like worships, you know, the old school Alex Raymond, Milt Caniff sort of school, rather than, you know, Stan Kirby. But he's really good, basically. And I always sort of underrated him, I think, growing up. And looking at his stuff now, I'm always like, yeah, it's really fucking good. It's really dynamic and lovely. And the first, like, issue or two of this is really, it's saved by how good the art is. But fucking hell, he feels what everyone else feels. This is some next level dog shit, right? by some stretch, the worst Morrison and Miller. And that includes their Vampirella comics and stuff like that. Because Vampirella, I mean, it's Vampirella. It doesn't matter. You can't really make a shit Vampirella comic because it's Vampirella. You know, I know there's some great people who worked on it, but at the same time, it's essentially like tits out, sexy vampire lady. And,
can you make a good one?
Yeah,
can you make
a
bad one? Or you can only make a Vampirella
comic? Just make a Vampirella comic. So right, they've written some dog shit. I mean, Skrull Kill Crew is pretty bad. Basically, Morrison and Miller together is usually a sign of something is not going to be that great.
I didn't mind Skrull Kill Crew.
It's okay. Actually, it's okay.
It was like, it was a sort of one idea stretched out. But
yeah,
it's an all right idea.
Their Flash run was pretty good. Aztec was okay. I mean, generally what you sort of start to see as well is that when they were writing together, it was probably that they were coming up with stuff and then one or other of them took the lead on the writing. And with the Dread stuff, I'm pretty sure that Miller is writing the most of it. But it's got that real kind of like, they were in this weird period of being kind of this sort of blokey, laddish, obnoxious personas, which reads really oddly now. There's some classic interviews with them, I think I mentioned this last time, from the 90s, where they were just like really rude and arrogant and sort of shitty in these kind of interviews about people. And it was fun. It was fun because no one was ever really like that. But some of it's dated really badly. Like, there's loads of bits where in these kind of faux obnoxious interviews where like Miller's going, they're being asked about what their take on Dread is, and Miller's going, "Ah, you're probably just going to write him like a puff, like you write Batman and all this stuff." And it's like, wow, okay. And I apologize for using that slur, but if I said the P word, I don't think anyone would have known. But it's just really like, wow, okay, that's not great. That's not a great look. It doesn't, you know. So there is, it's the product of this really like boorish sort of 90s faux lad persona that they were trying on, like a couple of naughty schoolboys. And, you know, it sort of worked a bit in terms of like bringing a sense of obnoxiousness back to 2000 AD. That was quite welcome and stuff. And parts of the Summer Offensive worked well, parts of it less so. But this is like well past that, and it is fucking shit. So basically what it is, and I don't mind the idea of a big dumb Dread strip. You know, I was precious about this at the time, and I remember being really annoyed about how dumb their stuff was and how kind of they weren't respecting the complex mythos that, you know, John Wagner had been working on, which is fair because he had been, and it was really good and is really good. But there's room in my heart for a sort of dumb action movie take on Dread if it's done with a sort of touch of wit and class. But this is like some Justice Department space probe or something has gone really far out into the galaxy and gone missing, and then it's come back. So there's this kind of spaceman who was aboard, who's sort of seen like beyond the veil, as it were, and is coming back and potentially has access to like an alien technology. But and it crash lands in the Antarctic, this space probe, and loads of judges from around the world are all kind of arrived to basically claim it, because the Antarctic is like is kind of, you know, neutral space. So you've got like Sov judges, Brit judges, there's a Vatican judge, an Aussie judge, Irish judge, and maybe like a Sino sit and Hondo sit ones. Those are Chinese, Japanese. Anyway, it's a kind of bunch of it's an international cast of judge characters, all basically racing to find this thing. But they all kind of arrive together, and it's almost like, right, on your marks, get set, go. Off they all go. And they're all like, everyone's like really antagonistic and sort of, you know, out to fuck each other over. But it's really, it just really makes no sense. It's like, well, hold on, why did you all arrive and almost go, right, hey, everyone, how's it going? Oh, right, anyway, let's go. Off we go. It just sort of is, it just makes no fucking sense. It's like, well, why are you being civil? Why wouldn't you just turn up and just literally be like, I'm going to drop a bomb on all of you and then go and get this stuff or whatever. So it's kind of fatally compromised already by just an inherent, like, dumbness. And then they are all sort of tracking down this artifact, this kind of crash landing thing, and it turns out that this guy has essentially been possessed, this judge has been possessed by a sort of evil shape-changing alien thing, and the Vatican judge is like the main baddie, but basically it's an excuse to revel in like the most annoying and offensive like national stereotypes and sort of cod racism. I mean, everyone is literally called, like the Indian judge is called, like, Judge Bargy. And, you know, oh, God, the Aussie judge and the Irish judge are just getting pissed. And, you know, part of me is like, it is quite funny. There's a sort of quite funniness to its, there's a quite sort of humorous element to its obnoxiousness. But it's so witless and so fucking dumb and just so, like, you know, Judge Bargy, it's just like, fuck off, man. It's not the 1970s. Yeah. Go fuck yourself.
Awful.
It's really awful. Like, I don't mind the kind of like, let's all have these sort of slightly stereotypical characters behaving in this kind of way. But there's a point at which it just crosses over into just straight up dumbo racism.
And, but it was a different time.
Oh, yeah, it was the 90s.
It was a different time. Ironic, yeah, yeah. You know? No, that different time was the 70s. Mm. And even then it was wrong.
And it's also like really just a reminder of how the fact that 90s was like a really crushingly ugly decade for a decade that seems to perceive itself as a sort of enlightened second summer of love moment of everyone having a great time. Everything was great in the 90s, wasn't it? There was loads of money. There were no problems in the world, even though there were. And actually, like, if you watch a lot of pop culture from the 90s, if you absorb anything, like watch old episodes of like The Word or The Girly Show or loads of those kind of horrible late night naked ITV game shows where everyone's just getting their knobs out for no reason and everyone's just pissed all the time on every show. It's like, let's just drink, everyone drink all the time. And it's just like this real regressive, ugly decade, actually. That starts to look much, much worse as time goes on. And also, you see a lot of the problems that we now are encountering in culture sort of stem from that. I mean, nothing stems from a starting point. It's a kind of, you know, threads kind of go throughout history. I get that. But I think there's a certain guilt that needs to be addressed in the 90s because you start to look at things like the 80s.
And irresponsibility.
Yeah, and complacency and a certainty that, like, you know, all this kind of ironic posturing couldn't possibly go anywhere bad, you know? And this, like, Dreadstrip is a total fucking product of it. It's so ugly and so dumb and so, like, witless. And, yeah, like, honestly, it's fucking awful. And Mick Austin, bless him, you can just feel him going, oh, this is so shit. And he starts off and it looks really nice. It genuinely saves it. The first couple of episodes look beautiful. And he just obviously, as this kind of dumb, you know, badly thought through, ill-conceived, essential slugfest just takes place with everything happening at the most like boneheaded level with no sort of surprises or anything. And Dredd's just being this massive dick throughout the whole thing because that's their reading of Dredd. Is he's just endlessly calling people meatheads. That is a Mark Miller thing. That is a total Mark Miller thing. If you read Robo Hunter, Rogue Trooper, any of his fucking strips from the 2000s, everyone is always calling each other meathead. Shut up, meathead! And it's just like this gross, obnoxious voice that he's got, which, you know, he found massive success with when he applied it to American comics after a while. And yeah, it's god awful. I fucking hated it. But I mean, when I say I fucking hated it, I sort of hate read it. It was like watching a really hateable movie or something. It went down quite quickly and easily. That's the one thing I would say about it, is it was so... It, because even though Morrison and Miller at their laziest and most slapdash and fucking obnoxious, they still know how to write enough of a way that you're not bored. You're sort of, I might have been appalled, but I wasn't bored. I wasn't like, this is a total sort of trudge. It was just, it did crack along and stuff. But it just made me think, like, you know, what a colossal misreading of Dread. What an ugly, you know, shitty comic. And I just don't know. I guess Dread is a bit of a... He's a bit of a rock at which people just sort of dash themselves against, isn't he? I mean, a few writers have now found the way to do it. But what they've done is they've essentially gone, oh, well, look, what you need to do is just do what John Wagner does and try and do that. Like, there is no, like, hot, fresh take on Dread, I don't think. I don't know what you do with it, because he's so, like, wed to Wagner's voice and his style, you know.
Yeah.
A funny one.
Yeah.
Like,
it is. There are people who make a good fist of it. But, I mean, I can't really comment because I'm not reading current Dread. You know, I'd like to have the time. But,
yeah, no. I mean, you know. I, you know, 2000 AD, modern 2000 AD is not my bag, as I've already established. But I do know that people are very fond of the Dread work that's been going on, so... it's just, I don't know, you know, I think
I'm going to just keep on buying the collections and one day hopefully
get to read them.
Yeah, yeah. as soon as I there's two little things need to happen. I need little Barry Lactus to be going to school, so I have a bit of time during the day. And then I need, once that's in place, I need to either win the lottery or get hit by a rich fucker driving like a fucking Ferrari or a Bentley the wrong way down a one-way street. And so I'm in bed with a broken leg, possibly some broken ribs, hopefully nothing, no internal organs too damaged. So I can't move, I can't do anything. I've got the perfect excuse and enough money to sit there and read comics. And I'm just waiting for that day at the moment. Let's hope I get run over soon by someone rich who is definitely in the wrong.
Yeah, gently and non-fatally run over. I just looked up Mick Austin on Wikipedia just out of interest to see what he's like. And he seems to have stopped kind of doing comics work in about 96, which would probably track with this, actually.
They finished him off.
And the last thing, one of the last things it says on his biography is, in 2003, he accompanied the Prince of Wales as tour artist to India and Oman. It's like, all right, okay, that's a bit of a change from doing shitty, like, Judge Dredd comics in the 90s. So good on you, Mick. Hope that paid well. A handsome fee. What else have you read?
What else? Well, where will we be going? Ooh, well, maybe I'll save that and talk about this. It's something I've been meaning to do for quite some time is read the best-selling comic, basically, and which is, of course, Dogman, which outsells all of the stuff. All, you know, this comics culture that we're in, that completely ignores. This, like, that is sort of scrabbling around in this little pit going like, oh, comics aren't for kids anymore. Why aren't anyone making any comics for kids? Oh, we're losing readership. Oh, this is the direct market. Oh, no one's like this. It's a dwindling. It's a dying medium. It's a dying medium. Fucking millions of people are buying Dogman by Dave Pilkey or Dav Pilkey. Apparently it is pronounced Dave.
What?
Do you not know about Dogman?
No. I just
you know about Captain Underpants.
Ah, it's a kit.
It's
right.
That guy.
Oh, now Dav- I see it. Yeah, have you just looked it up? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dogman. So I thought, no, I like what sort of comics podcaster and person who is interested in comics just completely ignores this, because it's like, you know, they come in books and they're sold in bookshops and this and kids read them. I don't know, there just seems to be this, like, it's so weird because it is selling millions.
Yeah.
It's like four, it's like something like 40 Dav Pilkey books are like 40% of the comics market or
right,
something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
And comics culture, like, you know, you didn't know who what Dogman was.
No.
Just then. You know? It's fucking insane.
Yeah.
And
it's actual proper sort of comics as well, isn't it? I'm just looking at it.
Yeah, it really is. And it's good comics, as it turns out. I bought the first volume. There's fucking 9 of them. Loads of, like, 200-odd pages in each, you know, thick thing. And I was reading it, and, all right, my perspective may be somewhat skewed in that most of what I read and watch currently is CBeebies and a few children's books which I read repeatedly to little Barry Lactus. So I am sort of tuned in, like my sort of mental age of reading is like, it can go quite high, but it is like the bar is low in terms of that, but I honestly really enjoyed. I haven't finished reading even this first volume yet, but it is so refreshing to read something that is straightforward, fun and funny, and within the context of something that's for kids, it is sort of oh God, what's the word? It's late, I'm tired. Subversive.
Yeah.
Dogman is like, I haven't read any Captain Underpants. I'm not well versed in Dave Pilkey's
oeuvre.
Yeah.
Oeuvre.
So all I've read is about half of the first Dogman book. It's got Dogman's origin. Well, first of all, there's an overall conceit in that it's not actually done by Dav Pilkey. It's done by two school friends. One of them writes it and one of them draws it. And they are like a sort of cipher for his school experiences, where he was diagnosed with ADHD and he's dyslexic. And he was seen as a sort of disruptive influence in class. This was obviously, I think he must be about our age, maybe. He was quite a lot of the time, he was sent outside of the class to like sit in the corridor where he would sit and draw. That's where he drew Dogman for the first time. That's where he drew Captain Underpants for the first time. It's like, imagine as teenagers, those comics we were drawing. Imagine still doing them.
Yeah.
And that's what this guy is doing. It's really quite remarkable. Okay, so you've got this conceit that they are by these two pals who get told, and it's got like, much like Watchmen, it's got these letters from their teacher at school sent to their parents. Yeah. You know, it's got this sort of extra added material. It's got the meta context of these two guys, and the stories themselves are like there's some. It's done in a sort of a purposefully childlike way. All the writing, and there's like super is always spelled S U P A. There's sort of very self conscious spelling mistakes. But that is really well balanced. If you're trying to get a kid to read, it's always words that they will know that, oh, that's spelt wrong, you know?
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, teaching children bad habits or anything like that. And then we go into Dogman, who's a comic that... the meta origin of Dogman is that these two friends... drew comics together at school, and they created a character called Captain Underpants. And then things got a bit crazy, and then they met up back in their treehouse, and they found an old comic that they did called Dogman. So they decided to draw them all again, and this time they'd fix all the spelling and draw real good. And then we have the origin of Dogman, where there's a policeman and his dog. And there's an evil cat. There's always just one villain, the cat. Oh, there's also an evil mayor. And the cat wants to get the dog and the policeman. So blows them up with a bomb. And then they end up in hospital. And the doctors are like, oh, policeman, your body is dying. And dog... policeman, your head is dying, and dog, your body is dying. We can't save them, but maybe we can combine them. So they just really crudely sew the dog's head on the policeman's body, and he becomes Dogman. And so he's like a policeman's body with a dog's head, and they very quickly become the best at fighting crime, because he can, like, you know, sniff villains and stuff. And there's this grumpy police chief who Dogman loves, but the police chief, like, he likes licking his face, but the police chief gets really grumpy with and always has a problem. He's always like jumping down his throat. But Dogman is very faithful to the chief, and it is fantastic. There's one story where it's not a great big long narrative. It's a series of sort of shorter stories in each book. Yes, but you know, long enough pages. There's like maybe sort of 4-6 panels a page. There's one where this evil cat. I can't remember the name of the evil cat. And I'd have to open the app to read it, my Kindle app. But anyway, this evil cat bastard, he notices that Dogman's clever because he reads books. So if he can get rid of all the books in the world, people will become stupid and he can do all the crimes he wants. So he invents a gun, which is like a pencil backwards with, like, the eraser pointing outwards. And he flies around the world and he gets rid of all the words in all the books, so all the books are blank. And then everyone becomes really stupid and he can do what he wants because he's got a few books that he keeps in his secret hideout so he can keep clever. But then the novelty of that wears off because just everyone's so fucking stupid. He just wants to buy a some donuts, and this person keeps selling him bagels, and just this litany of like stupid shit that everyone's doing is genuinely very funny. I'm trying to find an example now, and then there is also formal experimentation where we get to these Flippy-rama pages where in this story that I'm describing, Dogman manages to get his intelligence back somehow, I can't remember how, and the Petey, the evil cat, is trying to get his books back, and there's loads of books around this playground. And he's going, oh, no, there's another book by the seesaw. And then we go to a Flip-O-Matic where you've got, it's basically a flip book animation where you flip between two pages. So you've got some kids on a seesaw and the cat is trying to get the book from underneath the seesaw, but you flip it and the seesaw comes down on the cat's back and the cat's screaming. So you sort of flip it and the seesaw goes one way and then the other. I don't know if I'm describing this adequately, but they're really good. I'm going to buy loads of them. I'm just waiting till little Barry Lactus gets to about 6 years old.
Yeah.
And I can legitimately read these together. But I mean, fuck it. I can legitimately read them now. You get them on, Kindle or something like that. This first one was about £4 or something for 200 odd pages.
Yeah.
They're really good. And I just think it's amazing that there's this thing that is selling loads that is so dismissed by our culture, you know. It kind of blew my mind. It's really good.
It's like some weird... it's like some weird secret or something that isn't a secret. It's just that, we're not paying any attention.
It's almost like everyone was ignoring trees all along.
Yeah.
And then someone told them about trees.
Or
what they do. It's like, oh, wow.
Or like...
I don't know.
Or like not noticing the Beatles, but being like, they, you know, busying yourself with like, you know, where Skiffle how Skiffle had evolved and really like, you know, got into, you know, a real niche of Skiffle and not noticing the Beatles happening like that or something. I don't know. Like, it's just, I mean, I was just looking at it and it's really weird. It reminds me a little bit of when we used to do stuff. I remember like doing some sort of self-consciously badly drawn comic called, like, I think it was called like Chris Cat and Dave Dog or something. And it was just this real... almost like an exercise in, I'm not going to give it more credit than it deserved. I was like 16 or whatever, but it was like an exercise in trying to draw something as simply and quickly as possible and not laboring over it. And it was, I remember finding it really liberating because it was a lot funnier and a lot better than everything else I've been like twatting around doing, even though it was notionally a bad comic strip. And I was just looking at that and I was like, oh, that's kind of just what he's doing. He's just like literally shitting it out, like in the best way. Like it's just he's found a really accessible, like but aesthetically it's actually very pleasing, you know.
And the storytelling is impeccable. And these flip pages, they really were.
Well,
they're not like a novelty.
No.
They are truly effective and integral to the text, and it's great.
it's amazing. I'm thinking as well, because like you say, you know, I'm sort of looking at what point I might be able to introduce the Mini Beast to comics. I don't want to be like push it on.
Where is she going to get her damage?
What point can I? You know, I don't want to enforce it. I don't think that's the, you know, no. I don't think it's like necessary to be like, I like this, so you must like it. But I also we've been reading like the Mega Mog books, the Jan Pinkowski drawn Megan Mogg books, and I remember loving Megan Mogg and reading them with her, which she sort of really taken to it without any real pushing. I was like, oh, these are they're kind of comic strips, actually. They're like they have like sequential moments. They've got a real integration of like sound effects and
I do have a criticism of them in that I think the placement of captions is not logical a lot of the time.
In terms of like reading it aloud, it can be a bit, it's an odd experience. And they also follow like the most crazy dream logic. Some of the later Megan Moggs are just like, well, fuck knows what's happening here. But the actual aesthetics of them is really strong. Like
the colour, the simple sort of primacy of the artwork and stuff. But I was like, this is sequential storytelling of a sort, and she's engaging with it. And, you know, when I read them to her, I sort of do, you know, I have to say, oh, Al says this, and because there's a speech bubble. They've actually got speech bubbles and stuff in it. But I was just like, she's engaging with this in a slightly different way to how she engages with a story, like with a rhyme scheme or something like that, where part of the rhythm of the language is kind of what the appeal is. This is like, she's looking at this and it's like, what's really appealing is the way that these pages are put together and the kind of and so there is that thing where it's like, oh yeah, no, it comics is a language that you have to learn. And I do, I remember also giving my niece, when she was quite little, a Gary Northfield collection, his Teeny Tiny Sauruses, I think it was. And I sat, I think she must have been about six, don't know, maybe, can't have been older than that. And I remember she was like, what do I do? And she was looking at the page and I was like, oh, well, look, this is like the first panel. And you go this way. And I actually had to sort of go, oh, so this one leads to that one. And you jump to the next one and you go, oh, actually, it isn't intuitive. You know, it is a bit, but there is a sort of a way to read a comics page that if you don't know what, if you've never fucking seen one before, you're like, what do I do with this? Where am I reading? What am I looking at? You know, and you have to learn it. And some people glom to it very quickly and some people don't really, and just sort of it never really works for them. But anyway, it's just, it is something I'm very conscious of with my daughter, that I want her to experience that in her own way, so that she can see if she likes it, really. And something like this, Dogman, is perfect because it just looks great. Like, I think she would dig the humour and the energy of it and all sorts. And also, it really seems to me like it's avoided the pitfalls of being precious. Oh, I'm writing for children. It's like, no, I'm writing as a child almost. It's got that kind of energy. Yes. Yeah. And I think that's really key because I fucking hate that stuff. I hate it when people are like, oh, I know how to write for children. It's like, no, you don't. You horrible, smug, kind of condescending tone that people put on. It's like, no, no, no. So this is great.
It gets away with the style he's used. He gets away with a lot. And, yeah, it's got that, like, they really are fun to read. I think pretty much anyone could read them.
Yeah.
I would go that it isn't just for kids. I mean, you're better off reading this than some fucking Geoff Johns, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good. Just noticed that throughout it all, Dogman, you can see the stitches where his head's sewn onto his body, but because it's done so like so cartoony, like gets away with it. it's fucking fantastic.
You were saying about it, better than reading a Geoff Johns comic or something. I'm part of a part of it, makes it sound very special. There's a little like Twitter group that I'm, you know, I chat behind the scenes of, and it's a place that I often get to be much more of a grumpy old man than I even am on this show. But I think I genuinely wrote today that about modern comics. I said, the thing I don't like about modern comics is the writing, the art, the colouring and the letters. And the thing was, I meant it and I didn't even mean it as a kind of like, I sort of wrote it. Yeah, my main beef with modern comics is the art, writing, lettering and colouring. And it's just like, I really mean it though, because it's like everything is wrong at the moment. It's like there's too many words, there's too much writing. The art is horrible and like photo referenced, computer cleaned, totally generic. I don't know. Just I'm talking about superhero comics here, really. The colouring is like is kind of the
which the world doesn't care about.
Oh God! Yeah, literally, no one cares about.
Yeah, and then the public likes Dogman, and the public is right.
The public have spoken. No, but it's the same. You know, it's the same thing as I was when I was going through 2000 AD. I was like looking at it going, I don't like the way this looks. I don't like the way it reads. I don't like the colour, and I don't like the lettering. It's like, yeah. And then, you know, you've just said about Dogma, and I've looked at it for like 2 seconds. I'm like, I'm so much more into this. This is like way more. Just vibrant and exciting, and yeah, like, I don't know. That's blown my mind. It's like a completely secret thing that I've it's been hiding in plain sight, because I've actually seen Dogman books around in like Waterstones and stuff many times.
Me too. I think it was a post from a long time ago by Simon Russell. Who pointed that out, and I was like, oh yeah, I do need to check that out. And I finally got round to it, because I knew, like, you know, I thought the podcast, like, I just for the sake of the podcast, I need to read something else than, you know,
yeah,
than the usual. And I'm bloody glad I did.
Yes, and I never do that, so it's good to do it. Like, I'm just like mining the same increasingly infertile ground.
Hey, have you read anything from the early 90s, late 80s Comics Aren't For Kids Anymore?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, by the way, Biff Bang Pow, Comics Are For Kids Anymore, aren't for kids. As it turns out. That's what I meant to say with regards to Dogman.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's the Biff Bang Pow Comics Are For Kids, and also Biff Bang Pow Comics Aren't For Kids Anymore. I'll very quickly say my ongoing hero quests that I have to find certain obscure items. I put this up on the Silence group. The Death's Head graphic novel. The body in question that came out in about 89 or something, 90, maybe 91, maybe it might have been. It wasn't 80, anyway, whatever. It's really hard to find. It's really rare, and it just wasn't that many printed. It didn't sell very well, and those kind of Marvel graphic novels from that time are quite hard to find, especially the Marvel UK ones, and.
That was the end of that format, wasn't it?
It was, really, yeah. There was things like Night Raven, House of Cards, that came out, and there was a Doctor Who Voyager and stuff like that. That was a collection of some Steve Parkhouse drawn Doctor Who. Really nice, actually. That's a lovely, if you can ever find that. There's John Ridgway and Steve Parkhouse artwork for Doctor Who. It's really nice. But there's a bunch of Absalom Dark, I think I talked about the other day. There's a few things, and basically I remember just seeing them advertised in the Marvel UK comics, and I was always like, I want those, I want all of them. And the Death's Head one was like, because I love Death's Head, he was such a kind of, he was like a real fan favourite of mine, really. And it was so frustrating that this bloody book was always just out of reach. And I finally got a copy for, you know, an okay amount of money. I would have liked to have found it in a charity shop for a quid, but that just increasingly is not possible. So I was quite happy with what I paid for it. It's interesting. So it's kind of like Simon Furman and Jeff Senior, who were the creators of Death's Head, did this thing, which essentially is three issues of the Death's Head comic that's kind of been tarted up a bit, and deals with his origin, essentially. It's the origin of Death's Head, which is odd, so it's got his mum and dad in it. but it's weird, because it's sort of like... It looks great, because it's Jeff Senior is the sort of secret best action comic artist of all time in some ways. You know, there's a kind of kineticism and excitement to his action sequences that has sort of been unmatched by anyone other than like Frank Miller at his best in some days in my mind, and certainly because he was working in this really uninspired world of, not uninspired, but like Marvel UK properties. It was like, you're drawing Transformers and Action Force and stuff like this. No one's expecting it to be like great art. And like Senior really elevated stuff with his sort of dynamism.
Very, very dynamic.
Yeah, really dynamic. And he's not always great on certain things, but he's got a dynamism. Anyway, so this is like fully painted. It's lovely. It's vibrant. It looks great. It really is just a treat to look at. And Simon Furman, I'm a big fan of his writing. And I think, you know, Death's Head is is a fun character. But it is weird because actually what you realise is the one thing you didn't need to know about Death's Head is his origin. And he's much better, you know, as I think Robert Aitken, who's one of our regular listeners, sort of said, he was like, oh, you know, asking what I thought of it, and said, I think he kind of works best as a kind of cameo or in small doses. And I would agree entirely. Like, I like the Death's Head comic, but partly because each issue was essentially a standalone romp. And Death's Head himself is such a kind of unmoving, unwavering character. He's just this really positive, like, weirdly positive, like, psychotic cyborg who's got a ridiculous, you know, almost like a child's design of an evil robot face. And yeah, he's got this really cheery disposition, and he's got this commitment to professionalism, and he doesn't want to be called a bounty hunter, he wants to be called a freelance peacekeeping agent and all this stuff. And you know, he just turned up as a foil for like the Transformers. He then bounced into like Doctor Who, he sort of turned up in like Dragon's Claws and all this stuff, and he's a great cameo character. And then when they did his own comic, it worked well because it was this kind of like fun knockabout sci-fi thing that wasn't 2000 AD, it was something else, and it just sort of worked. And actually it is a bit like, yeah, this doesn't quite work because there's more room to breathe, there's more sort of space given to it, but it doesn't really need it. I don't want to know where he comes from. It's quite fun where he comes from, and there's some fun stuff, but you know, the last thing I need is like is a character like Death's Head to have some sort of daddy issues bullshit. I just want him to be like, he just arrived fully formed. He just turned on one day and there he was, ready to go, ready to just kill people happily and be his sort of enjoyably psychotic self. and yeah, so it's one of those things where it's like, not bittersweet. I'm really happy to have it. I love it. And it fills a gap that has been literally 20 years in the making, probably more like 25 years in the making. So there's that, but yeah, it is weirdly like unsatisfying in some ways because it sort of doesn't really work for the character, but totally worth it for Jeff Senior's art because he's very underseen really, and these graphic albums have a bit more space and a bit more room to breathe. Although, it, like I say, I really think it was just I think that the comic was cancelled prematurely, and I think this might have just been the next three issues of it. I don't know. Sort of has that feel because it's broken into three chapters, and I'm like, that's sort of 20 odd pages per, yeah, that's about a comic. There's quite a lot of that. I realised that a few things are like that. There's Grant Morrison's Kid Eternity, which is a three issue prestige format. Suddenly realised it's like each of those is broken into like Canto, so pretentious, Canto 1, Canto 2, Canto 3, and there's like each of those is broken into kind of two cantos per book, and I was like, oh, this was a six issue miniseries that then they were like, once Duncan Fegredo was involved, they were like, let's paint the fuck out of this and make it a 48 page prestige format, baby, you know. But I think, like, you know, maybe Morrison just wrote it like, oh yeah, it's just a six issue fucking run. It's just, I'm always fascinated when you see things like how they start off somewhere and they end up somewhere else, you know. Anyway, so yeah, it's nice to have it. It's definitely really nice to have it, but yeah, I do prefer my Death's Head in small chunks and as a bit more of a fun supporting character, like
within the context of something else.
Yeah, definitely. He bounces off people really well because there's something, this kind of cheery but very deadly cyborg thing, this ridiculous looking cyborg is a great character to have turn up in your comic and shake things up a bit. But yeah, what it doesn't warrant is sort of psychological interrogation of any sort. You know, it just doesn't, and partly because so it's kind of not a great success, but fuck it. Yeah, and that's but fuck it. That's my birthday message to you, but fuck it.
Yeah well, I mean,
I think we're probably reaching the end, unless you want to rip through something quickly.
Well, I did read I got an issue of Jim, Jim Woodring's Jim. I got number 2. I'd had this for a while, but I finally got around to reading it. It's just interesting reading some Jim Woodring, which is not...
Frank.
Which is not Frank. I've got a collection of Jim stuff. I still don't think I've read it. I've had it for about 15 years or something. I still haven't read it. Because it's not Jim. But I read this. It's got a sort of autobiographical story in it. Brilliantly drawn. Really odd. The whole comic is like the work of a very competent madman. Just this, like, a lot of them are... There's text stories in it. There's a lot of text stories, and all the text is handwritten.
Of course.
So you've just got these pages and pages of just handwrittenness. Like, you've got the editorial page. Jim today. This is grim, folks. What is this thing called Jim? In my hometown, we have a saying. I believe in self-torture. I first heard it said when I was just a child. My next-door neighbour, also a child, uttered the admirable catchphrase as he deliberately crushed his left index finger in a vice. Vice spelled F-I-V-I-C-S-E. I don't know if that's the right spelling. When the bone ends in the big knuckle exploded with the noise like a gunshot, we exchanged a look of holy horror. He had gone way past mere show, which is all I was ever capable of. The finger was permanently ruined, but he sailed through life with a real lust for fun, because as he had so practically demonstrated, he really did believe in self-torture. I never actually heard anyone else use that phrase, but I saw that any number of people felt that way. I saw almost everyone inflicting upon themselves the most appalling and degrading injuries, ruining... This is the editorial at the beginning. Appalling and degrading injuries, ruining their standings in their families, forcing themselves onto a slow track that led only to pain, shame, and death, and never pursuing the corresponding opportunities for glory. I believe in self-torture, said the fat drunk, hated by his lost, vainglorious children. I believe in self-torture, said the fading beauty, whose great desire was to be loved for her looks. I believe in self-torture, said the spoiled intellectual, whose lack of effort would never pay off. In fact, almost everyone, or so it seemed to me, wanted to suffer. When I opened an unripe peach and found a tiny brain inside, I felt the urge to torture myself. When I hit my face on the wall of the ditch, I wanted to be punished for my own good. When I was pursued by a wretch my own age who was whipping all the kids with a dead rat snake, I wanted to atone for the snake's demise. When I destroyed an enemy's foot with a pickaxe, when I was hit in the head with a rock, when I was ditched at night during the games, I wanted to suffer agonies. And I did suffer at night, and during the day, at school, and at home, with my parents and with my enemies, alone and among friends, I suffered and cried gallons of tears, and ran away and generally felt like shit. But I never did believe in self-torture. I believed in the elimination of bad blood, in burying the hatchet, in union under heaven. Is this why I suffered? Jim is all about suffering, and it is about the unrequited love of beauty, and it is about the great horror of existence. It is about eyes that must see perfectly dreadful things and yet live on. Is it funny? Is it clever? Is it charged with ambition? Well, perhaps. Well, these things, these pleasant virtues, are certainly found in the eye of the beholder. Jim exists in the eye of the lobster. However, the reason Jim is about suffering is because it longs for what comes afterwards. Calling old cobras. Bastard at my door. I may be dead by the time... It goes on.
Fucking
it's a good
hell.
Comic.
What the fuck?
It's a good comic.
Yeah, no.
And the story inside is like, yeah, I think, you know, it was a period at Jim Woodring's life where it is not the Jim Woodring that we see in the Jim Woodring documentary, who's sort of happy and in a way and considered and is married.
Yeah.
And has successfully bred.
Yes, he's a man in his 20s instead.
Yeah, or I don't know, maybe late 20s, 30s, maybe.
Yes, possibly. It's curdling a bit before the upswing of.
But yeah, no, it's a very interesting read, but
and exquisitely drawn, I would imagine as well.
Yes, but I won't go on.
Shall
because
we?
I don't want to ruin your birthday.
You're getting close to ruining it, officially.
Let's go away from the birthday review universe. Where we have lots of birthday fun. Maybe the closest the Beast Must Die gets to seeing a friend. Because it's your birthday.
It is. Happy day.
Because, yes, during a global pandemic.
You
can't see anyone.
It's birthdemic.
For your birthday, Donald Trump is going to come back. He's going to be president for a day and do all sorts of damage. And because it's your birthday, I'm going to get really into QAnon.
Good. Hope so.
Yeah.
Might spice things up a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, all sorts of many birthday treats for you. Right, we're going to do this this Choose Your Own Adventure.
Are
we?
No, we're probably not, are we? Oh, have you got time? You haven't got time. Shall I just?
I do have time.
All right, hold on. So here we go, Gary Lactus. You are about to start playing.
Hey, this might be someone's first episode. Do you want to trail it very briefly?
So, yeah, our last episode we talked about... I talked about an adventure game book that I had that I wanted Gary Lactus to play some of because... I can't remember the reason why. Because I thought you'd love it. And so these were... Briefly... When Fighting Fantasy Books by Steve Jackson and Ian Livingston's very successful fantasy game books, the adventure game books of the early to mid 80s was their heyday, really. There was a bunch of them. They were great. I loved them. They are basically a book like Choose Your Own Adventure, but there's a bit more involvement. So you roll dice and, you know, you fight things in a form of combat, you know. And they were huge. Yeah, you just cheat and win. They were hugely enjoyable stuff. And I very late in the day, a couple of years ago, found out that there were they were published by Puffin, the Fighting Fantasy books, and Puffin put out these things called the Starlight Adventures, which were adventure game books that were geared towards girls. So unlike Forest of Doom and the Citadel of Chaos and Scorpion Swamp and Starship Traveller and all those ones, we have things like Danger on the Air, which is all set at a local radio station. And there was other ones. Hold on, let me just see if I can bring up the others. There were about five of them. And obviously they didn't quite take in the same way. There was Star Rider, which was all set at horse riding. The Riddle of the Runway, which I'm not sure about. Island of Secrets seems to be some sort of holiday-based affair. Danger on the Air, and then there's one I'm desperate to get called Trance. Oh, Ice Dancer. Can you guess what Ice Dancer is about? And Trance. And Trance looks amazing. Trance is it looks kind of like a sort of sci-fi mystery one. Anyway, they're really hard to get hold of. They obviously, the print runs are quite low. They didn't do so great. They're very, very rare. But I managed to get hold of one of these. So I've got Starlight Adventure number 4, Danger on the Air. Do you want to hear the setup, right?
Yeah.
Can you be a radio star? Something is going sour at Radio South. The bustling, lively atmosphere of this thriving local radio station where you are a reporter has taken a turn for the worse. There's a hint of scandal in the air, a scandal that could spell disaster for the station and everyone involved. It's up to you to find out who's behind it. Could it be Jerry Smith? Streetwise, always with an eye to the main chance. Could it be Ron, the brash and unpredictable lead singer of the Bandits? Or could it be someone far more sinister? The answers...
Ron.
The answers are hidden somewhere in this whirling adventure of mystery and romance. All you have to do is to make the choices, decide who to trust and which clues to follow. And if you're lucky or very clever, you might just win through. That's what the back says. So, we shall start. Right.
Yes, please.
Just to tell you who you are, you, the heroine, are a journalist with Radio South, an independent local radio station. You arrived here via a job on a local newspaper where you served a 2.5-year apprenticeship. Competition for jobs in radio is fierce, so you're justifiably pleased with your achievements. This is so different from, like, Scorpion Swamp. Your job involves...
I am pleased with my achievements.
Your job involves reporting, going out with a tape recorder to interview a variety of people. You're expected to edit tapes and write the introduction, which you then read on air, in quotes. You also write and read pieces for the local news programme and contribute items to other programmes, among them a nightly pop music slot, also in quotes. It's a hard but exciting life, involving a certain amount of shift work and requiring a good deal of time and energy. You are ambitious and hope one day to produce and present your own programme and to make a real success of your career in broadcasting. Two men figure in your life.
Even though you're a girl.
Oh, mate. Trust me, gets there. Two men figure in your life as the story starts. Andy Anderson, who presents a number of the evening pop programmes, and Simon Lewis, who produces them. Amusing and relaxed, Andy is...
Is pop still in quotes at this point?
Oh, yes. I don't think it will ever not be in quotes. Andy is popular with the listeners. Amusing and relaxed, sorry. He gives the impression of making no effort while actually being extremely capable. He's dark and handsome, with an eye for the girls, including you! Exclamation mark. Simon Lewis is blonde, with boyish good looks and an easy manner. His efficiency and supreme confidence have made it easy for him, so far, to succeed in broadcasting. As your adventure gets underway, you will find yourself having to make various choices. Making the correct ones will, as in everyday life, be a matter of judgment, but occasionally you'll have to rely on luck, where only a throw of the dice can determine your next step. Now read on. Isn't that a thrilling setup?
It really is a thrilling setup.
I'm not going to go. We're not going to go too far. This could be a regular feature. Actually, I'm thinking.
Yeah. So maybe this could be a Patreon thing.
Yeah, yeah. We'll start off here, and if people want, they can pay, and we can do a Patreon. I think that's a good idea. This is a taster for an ongoing 28-part Patreon series. We're definitely going to do. 1. It is mid-morning at Radio South. The daily breakfast show is over, and you and the rest of the team of journalists are attending a planning meeting in the newsroom. The meeting concerns the news stories and features scheduled for the remainder of the day. The item under discussion at present is a story which has appeared in the local press, hinting that the allocation of flats in a prestige town centre block, built and owned by the council, is being made for political and other reasons, and not according to need. It's a delicate subject. Much thought is being given to how to obtain an interview with an official at the housing department. To your surprise, the news editor, whose job it is to assign work, suggests that you might like a try! Exclamation mark. There is a small murmur of protest from the more experienced male journalists. The news editor waves them aside. They might respond better to a pretty young woman, he says. Here we go. A couple of the younger journalists grin, knowing only too well your views on sexism at work. If you protest, turn to 189. If, perhaps wisely, you keep your views to yourself, turn to 162. So, Gary Lactus, do you protest at this comment, or Perhaps wisely keep your views to yourself.
Perhaps wisely. Well, well, there's conflict here because there's it's not just you and me here, Dan.
No.
Like, you know our views.
There's all our impressions
on women's place.
Absolutely. They're firm and in place.
So I'm going to take the woke snowflake view of protesting. Because that's probably what all these women are doing these days. I'm going to protest.
Okay, good on you. Good on you, Garrulactus.
Yeah, yeah.
189, right. Okay, let's see what happens with your protest. I can't see that being female and pretty has anything to do with it, you say indignantly. Can you say that indignantly? Your line is, I can't see that being female and pretty has anything to do with it.
I can't see that being female and pretty has anything to do with it.
Yeah, okay, that was good. You ask the news editor? Wait until you've been in the business as long as I have. Guffaws of laughter greet this. Come on, he goes.
Oh, that really annoys me.
Do you think you can handle it or not? I can always send someone else. You decide hastily that you can and will handle it. Turn to 227.
Okay. So the option before was it goes straight to 227.
Shall we see how it would have panned out if perhaps wisely you'd kept your views to yourself?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So if you'd gone to 162, although this is breaking the rules.
Okay, right.
You keep quiet despite the grinning faces, but one of the other journalists protests. Look, I don't agree most of the blokes who work for the council are pretty conventional. They might prefer her to look at, but would they feel able to talk to her? Would they take her seriously? The news editor seems to find the whole episode vastly amusing and inquires what you think. What do you think?
Oh, okay.
Do you agree? Right. Or do you strongly disagree? So do you agree that most of the blokes who work for council are pretty conventional? They might prefer her to look at, but would they feel able to talk to her? Would they take her seriously? Do you agree or do you strongly disagree?
Oh, I don't know. all right. Yeah. Okay. Well, that this isn't. I thought this would course correct quicker than it has.
Do you agree or do you strongly disagree?
All right. Do I agree that the guys at the council would like to look at me?
But might not take you seriously. What do you I mean, it's just so hard to know what exactly you're strongly disagreeing against. But yeah, so.
Yeah, yeah. Fuck it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm agreeing. Yeah,
all right, you
absolutely.
Agree. All right, let's see.
Yeah.
I'm
hot stuff.
You are hot stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I don't like to think they would take me seriously, but if that's the case, perhaps it would work to my advantage because they might feel that by granting me an interview, they weren't actually putting themselves at risk, says the news editor. Interesting logic. Let's hope you're right. Get on the phone now and see if you can fix an interview.
This is the local council.
Get on the phone now and see if you can fix an interview for early this afternoon. I expect you've got some copy to write for the lunchtime bulletin first. Yes, I have. Fine. Good luck. And he goes back to his office, turned to 227. So that's when it course corrects back to 227.
Right, okay. Right.
And that, I think, is where we leave chapter one of Danger on the Air.
Danger on the Air. Oh, man, I want to do this.
You're going to play the whole book. You are going to. Whether we put this on Patreon or whether we do it as its own, it's part of Silence, I'm not sure yet, but you are playing this whole book.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, we can just steal little bits of time here and there. I want to do this. I really want to do this.
I've always dreamt of
being a young female reporter for a local radio station, and this I didn't know I'd always dreamt of that, but I know now. And yes, please.
Yes. Yeah, you're enjoying working at Radio South. That's good. Okay, listeners, I hope you liked that little new special exciting feature that we've carefully planned for you. And yeah.
Thank you. And yeah, who knows? Maybe that will be turning up on Patreon. Patreon.com/silence. Thank you so much to all the Patreonizers who have, all the members of C Unit who help keep us engaged and enthused in doing this for you. And let's face it, mostly for ourselves. Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff there. It's all, like, you know, that you can get. Loads of stuff. Not going to go on about
it.
The Beast Must Die has a birthday. He needs to go to bed. He needs to have a nice sleep. And he has to wake up and have his lovely birthday. He's going to have a lovely day of work for his birthday. And have a lovely day.
A lovely day.
I, for one, hope that it is a magical day. And I think, as a treat, The Beast Must Die. Yeah. Maybe I will write the show notes and edit it and get
wow.
it. Would you like that?
I'd love that.
Would you
yeah.
like that for
I'd
your
love
birthday?
It. I would love it.
Well, until next time, dear listener, thank you so much for joining us here in my car. It's lovely to have you here in my car with me. Very quickly, any other business?
None from me, sir.
None from me either. So, join us next time here
on Silence!